It would be kind of, I guess, in keeping with what we've been discussing tonight. First of all, David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art, for having me on again.
Happy to have you. It's kind of an interesting discussion tonight, David. I talked with Bob White for an hour, who had an amazing sighting and actually has an artifact from that sighting. And even before I had him on, I was sort of, I don't know, I guess reminiscing that I was a skeptic at one time. Until it happened to me. Twice.
Yeah.
And that changes you for life. And I know there are a lot of people in our audience tonight that have never had a sighting. They've never seen a disc or a UFO or whatever. They never have. And they're probably pretty skeptical. Well, Bob's life changed. My life changed. Obviously, as I just read in 1968, your life changed. Apparently forever, or at least through this moment. What happened to you in 1968?
Well, it's actually quite amazing because in 1967, 68, I was born in 61 in Berkeley, California. Walking home from school, we used to be, you know, Star Trek fans back then, and my brothers and I were all gang up and watch Star Trek after school. And we used to drop pennies, and my friend Tommy and I, down the manhole to hit the guy on the head with the, you know, the orange hard hat. He would come running up screaming after us, and we would hide. I remember dropping the penny, hitting the guy in the head, and when he came up, we were running, and we noticed everyone's looking at this metallic disc shining in the sky, and everyone came out of the manhole. The whole street was packed, and I remember people knocking on their neighbors' doors. And there's this shiny, metallic, you know, shimmering UFO, and we thought, oh, it's the Starship Enterprise.
Huh.
And, you know, when we got home and I told my father and my mother what I had seen that day, it was like, no, those things don't really exist. I mean, that's just a TV show. But I had a series of dreams, repeated dreams of one set of multicolor lights spinning one way and one spinning the other way, the opposite direction, on the same axis. And what's interesting about the dream is many years later, as actually in the 1970s, three physicists, Bardeen, Cooper, and Schaefer, won the Nobel Prize for what is known as Cooper's pairs. And they spin electron pairs in opposite directions on the same axis, and they get superconductivity, the ultimate state of conquering, you know, inertia and resistance. So there had to be some meaning to the dream, and there was the answer, you know, many years later.
But you had an unqualified experience, not a dream. You actually...
No, I saw the UFO. It was the dreams that followed the experience of seeing the UFO.
So as a kid, you dropped pennies on workers.
Yeah,
for fun.
For fun, yeah. I remember him getting so pissed off at that. Oh, if he catches us, he's going to kill us.
Well, all right. So you grew up to be an adult. researching UFOs, and you turned from wanting to be an astronaut. That was, I guess, very early, huh?
Well, actually, at that time, my stepfather, Dave Cooper, was a science teacher, and I was collecting scrap missions of every Apollo mission there was and just dreaming about going into space. And I really believed. In fact, I remember one day eating lunch at a restaurant in Vancouver, Canada, and this man just standing up out of the blue and tapping me on the shoulder, I've never seen him before in my life, and he says, excuse me, sir, but I see you as an astronaut in your future. And then he went and sat back down. And I thought, oh, my God, maybe I'm really going to make it, or I'm going to get abducted one day. I don't know what, one of the two.
All right. So now as an adult, would you regard yourself as, I guess, a ufologist, huh?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I have been able to be in the company of some of the greatest physicists of our time, working on nuclear fusion and working on hydrogen breakthrough technologies and a lot of high-tech stuff, including bomb detection for major, major physicists. And I was able to be a fly-on-the-wall theoretical physicist for years in front of people like, you know, Bogdan Magwitch, Murray Gell-Mann, Norman Rostocker, Glenn Seaborg, who chaired the Atomic Energy Commission.
Well, how did your belief in ufology get you next to these guys?
Well, I kind of keep it secret. I mean, in fact, even today in the hallway, I bumped into a UCLA physicist, Jim Roseborough, who's a professor of physics at UCLA, and he said, I don't believe in UFOs. In fact, technically, they're not even allowed to believe in UFOs because they just get laughed at.
Oh, yes.
And maybe in secret, a lot of them do. In fact, you end up finding out when they retire. they're very interested. But while they're in office, in fact, I remember sending Murray Gell-Mann, the 1962 Nobel Prize winner in physics, who is said to be the greatest scientist since Einstein by many physicists today, discoverer of quarks and all these subatomic particles.
Yes.
And I worked with him. You know, he was in the company of the physicists I worked for in fusion. And when I sent him the tape on the NASA UFOs, he was really upset.
I still am unable to grasp how your work in ufology got you next to these guys. Or were you legitimately working in...
No, I was legitimately working for them, and they didn't know about my interest in UFOs. I was working for them trying to do, like, Bogdan Castle-Magg, which had developed a nuclear fusion device using helium-3 and deuterium, which is far beyond cold fusion, far beyond tritium fusion. And then I met all of these guys. I met the head of the Russian space program at the time.
You were working as a, would you characterize yourself as a scientist or a scientific, perhaps some sort of scientific assistant? Where would you put yourself?
Well, where I was is I got a letter one day from John Bryson, who just took over Southern California Edison. He's an ex-environmentalist who becomes the new CEO of Edison. And Edison decided to invite me to bring in all these alternative energy scientists. This is back in the late 80s. And I read about Bogdan Magwitch. There was an article called Bogdan Magwitch Knows How to Make Non-Radioactive Nuclear Power, So Why Isn't He? In the Omni 9th, February 87 issue. And I phoned him up and I said, you know, the president of Edison wants to meet you. So I met Magwitch on the steps of Edison. That would be 1987, 88. And I thought it was going to be a slam dunk. I thought this guy had scores of Nobel laureates supporting his work. He had already funded three prototype models. In 1987, the Air Force at Kirtland in New Mexico just finished feasibility studies on Super Cray 2s to find out if the next stage would achieve beyond break-even fusion using helium-3 fuel. And helium-3 fuel is so energetic, Art, 9 grams of helium-3 can produce the energy of 1,000 barrels of crude oil. It is far more energetic than cold fusion. I'll give you an example. Just so you have
is this a hot fusion process?
It's hot fusion. In fact, there are people who don't even believe, and I've talked to many, in fact, I talked to Seaborg about cold fusion. Seaborg was the head of the AEC and, of course, responsible for all the nuclear testing in Nevada. He said he didn't believe it was fusion. He said it was some sort of a chemical reaction that was causing the heat, and then they convert the heat to energy.
A hot fusion reaction producing what kind of temperatures?
You're not going to believe this, but
try me.
Okay, 10 billion degrees with no heat radiating out of the reactor.
10 billion degrees. All right.
Which is ridiculous.
Isn't there a problem in containing something that produces that kind of heat?
That's the first reaction that everybody says. So to give a comparative model, the government fusion reactor at Princeton, which is tokamak fusion, they fuse deuterium and tritium, and they get about 100 million degrees, and they have a lot of problems containing the temperature.
Okay, well, I'm asking that question.
Yeah.
If you produce something of that temperature, how do you contain it?
Here's how it's done. The genius of Magwitch was that he built a self-colliding beam magnetic field that every time the heat or energy tries to radiate out, the magnetic field keeps throwing it back into the center. That's why it gets so intensely concentrated in the center of the device, and he was able to clobber tokamak fusion in temperatures. You need a billion to fuse helium-3. You need 100.
All right, just a speculative question,
yeah,
David, but if you had a fusion reaction of this magnitude going on,
mm-hmm,
and unlike a conventional reactor, you have a water problem. You've got a little fudge time in there to correct things. But it seems to me if you lost your magnetic field,
mm-hmm,
it would be very unpleasant.
Well, that's what it seems
wouldn't
like.
It? I mean, wouldn't that be a problem?
No, in this case it wouldn't be. In fact, it's very safe, and I'll explain why. Most nuclear reactions, including slow fission of uranium, you're basically taking energy in the form of heat and boiling water. And water, of course, you get pressure on pipes, and there's a lot of, of course, radiation.
Right.
Slow fission of uranium produces 200 million electron volts per fission, and you lose 60% of that by the time you convert your thermal conversion from heat back into electricity because you're boiling water and turning turbines.
Sure.
Cold fusion, deuterium produces 3.67 MeV, which is a fraction of that, and you lose 60% again because it's a heat thermal conversion, which leaves you with about 1.2 MeV. Now, helium-3 fusion is benign. There's no heat conversion. It produces all charged particles that convert directly into electricity, cutting out or obviating the heat cycle and making it much more efficient. And plus...
So you're saying there is no heat cycle.
There's no heat cycle.
No heat cycle. And he had this working.
He had three models developed working, and then the Air Force at Kirtland did tests for the final model on Super Cray 2s to simulate the reaction.
Yes.
And the results were classified, described as groundbreaking work on fusion power, which I had access to those reports. The reports were so stunning, they said there was no reason, no instabilities. They would attain beyond break even. 1 square meter would produce a gigawatt. That's a full-scale nuclear module, 1 gigawatt, a billion watts in a square meter, and 9 grams of the fuel, which you can hold in your left hand, and that'll produce the energy of 1,000 barrels of crude oil. So,
all right, so what happened to this device? I mean, they confirm it virtually on a Cray computer, and then what?
Then what happens is James Fletcher, who's head of NASA in the late 80s, and Earl Van Lanningham, whom I've had very long conversations with about fusion and UFOs, he was head of propulsion, power, and energy at NASA, and they were begging for this thing. They were like, the space station has these solar panels up there. They have very, what are in terms of, you know, doing high energy experimentation in space, they have a very small amount of power on the space station.
Right.
They would love to have a lot more. They would love to have a gigawatt.
Of course.
They're nowhere near that. They're in the 100 megawatt range, you know, down in that range right now. So a gigawatt is a dream. And further, Van Lanningham said that you could use the reactor and you could open a iris, open and closing iris at the back of the reactor. And he said 18 MeV protons, that's 18 million electron volt protons, could, as an anti-proton propulsion system, could send spacecraft up to 1/10 the speed of light, which is 67 million miles an hour. And today, we can only do, the space shuttle does 18,000 miles an hour.
So now you're telling me we've got a energy source and a propulsion system.
That's what Dr. Van Lanningham told me. So
all right.
He said the studies were being done at the University of Wisconsin at Madison into anti-proton propulsion systems. And based on the two criteria that NASA needed, propulsion and an energy source, James Fletcher approaches Congress, this is late 80s, asks for the funding to complete the reactor. They turned him down. It's a really amazing story, but he ends up...
Amaze me. I mean, if something is that good, why would you turn it down?
It's amazing. And even at that time period, I believe in the last days of Howard Hughes' life, he was very close to signing the check himself, but in fact, he read it personally, but never got around to signing it before he died. Every investor, I had a company, well, firstly, in 1992, was appointed as director of the L.A. Tesla Foundation, and under that foundation, we were promoting scientific discoveries for a better environment. I was invited to speak in Congress in 93, which is, you know, Clinton Gore's reign, and we spoke in Congress with a handful of some of the most brilliant physicists in this country to a panel that was only 50% present. Harry Hamlin, the actor from L.A. Law, was there, and he personally was trying to get Gore to sit in on the hearings, Al Gore. And Al Gore didn't even want to come to the hearings. No one, hardly anyone showed up. We made our speech, and we were turned down again.
Why?
Well, this is where it gets really, really, really quite wicked. In the Tesla Foundation, I was asked by Dr. Magwitch to do fundraising with all the oil companies and all the, you know, the philanthropy foundations. And I remember being on the phone with Royal Dutch Shell, and I got the most intimidating person on the phone. He was saying, "You do not want to continue and pursue this any longer."
David? Here's where I stop and ask you, if you're going to fundraise for a new energy source that's going to put the oil companies in the crapper,
in the crapper.
Maybe the oil companies wouldn't be the first ones you'd approach for funding, or would I be off base?
Well, actually, to protect their investment as a hedge, they better.
Well,
you know, if they're...
So you mix in a little blackmail.
You mix in a little blackmail, but this guy was... He wouldn't let me get off the phone. I mean, this man was basically telling me he could ruin my life.
Really?
And I was like, excuse me, sir, but I'm, you know, I respect that you don't want to fund this, but I have to, you know, get off the phone. And he would not let me get off the phone. He wanted me to understand who they were. And he was so, his authority was so beckoning with power.
Do you realize who you're talking
exactly.
to, son?
It was just like that. And I was so terrified. I was like, oh, my God, can I just get off the phone now? I don't want to talk to you anymore.
You and your family are at dire risk.
Exactly.
Do you realize that, Mr. Sarita? You want to really keep talking to me about this? That kind of thing?
Look what happened to our friend Eugene Malov, whom I also had many conversations
with. Well, we're not sure what happened in the murder of Dr. Malov. We don't know.
We really don't know. But it is whether I often think it was, if it was an accident or a coincidence, is it a psychic level that he was being attacked where you know, physical beings intervened on the dark side, or was it a real hit job where the CIA or whoever...
We don't know. But
we don't know.
We sure know it was a murder.
But it's one thing I'll tell you about cold fusion, and this is a concern for national security, and Hoagland brought the point up, but didn't finish it, and that is that cold fusion, deuterium is 3.67 MeV, but 33% radioactive neutrons. And when you have a radioactive neutron source, you can use it to potentially breed plutonium from uranium. But I don't know if the neutrons are strong enough in cold fusion, 3.67 MeV. It would take an awfully long time, but you could probably do it. And that would mean it would pose a security threat for terrorism. You wouldn't want a rogue nation learning how to build one of these and having their own neutron source. But with helium-3, there are no neutrons. There's no gamma rays, there's no X-rays, there's nothing other than pure energy.
Well, you know who heads up CSETI, right?
Who what?
Who heads up CSETI?
Seth Shostak, or who's the head of it?
No, that's SETI.
Yeah.
CSETI is what I'm referring to.
Oh, yeah, right.
Dr. Greer.
Sure.
Dr. Greer is looking for somebody just like you or with claiming to have the kind of technology that you claim you have, David. He's looking desperately for someone like that. Why have you not gone to Dr. Greer?
Well, I'm going to tell you an amazing story about...
So, to reiterate, David stumbles upon a process that would make a perfect fuel for interplanetary travel, certainly. It would make the need for oil virtually to be nearly eliminated or almost eliminated. It would take over the world's energy needs. That's pretty big stuff. And as I said, Dr. Greer, for example, is searching high and low for somebody who has something just like you claim you have, David. So,
well, again, I was, you know, working for, I ended up, you know, doing the Tesla Foundation, and then I formed my own company. I actually got a Middle Eastern partner to fund a company called the Green and Blue Corporation, and that was 92-ish. And we were set out to close contracts for venture capital on, you know, this particular fusion technology, breakthroughs in hydrogen, breakthroughs in solar power. And we personally met, I mean, people like David Ambrew Menhall I met, who is the head of Lloyd's of London. I met people like George Stranahan, who owned Champion Spark Plugs and just liquidated it for $500 million. The Resniks, who own the Franklin Mint. The Saudi royal family, I've sat down with princes and heads of, I mean, I've literally...
And did they all say no?
They all, well, even the head of Solomon Brothers. What ended up happening, I mean, the very head of Solomon Brothers in New York, my partner got a meeting for Dr. Magwitch, and the ones that were interested would confide in the Department of Energy and ask them for an investment decision, because this is a major decision to get involved in this, and head of DOE Fusion Program would always say no to them. So I ended up getting this rare telephone call that no one in the company could get for like an hour on the phone with the head of the DOE Fusion Program, And his name was David also, but I can't remember his last name. It's been so long.
And what did he say?
And I said, could you at least, if Congress will not fund this themselves, could you at least give our investors a green light? Because if we don't fund this, and somebody else does, Louise Kessler, who wrote Capital Manifesto, said the first person who does this, meaning helium-3 fusion, will be the first trillion-dollar corporation in the world. That's what kind of power we're dealing with here.
Yes.
Nearly one-third of all revenue in the world is in oil, is in energy, and another third are devices that are codependent on energy. So
sure.
When you change that, you are changing the economic powers of the entire planet, and that's why this is so intimidating. And especially something, now let's also
all right,
point out.
Help me out. I'm just a talk show host,
okay.
David. But somewhere here, I don't know if I can put you in a position to do this, but the average person would say, look, somewhere in this, there's a hole. There's a big but. There's a danger. There's something that somebody like the head of the DOE would hold up and say, wait a minute, here's why you can't do it. They would claim some kind of hole in the whole theory.
They would. And
what would that be?
Okay, so this is where it gets really like, this is like a football game. On one side, you've got people like Murray Gell-Mann saying we should fund this, who's Nobel Prize winner. Glenn Seaborg, who is basically Dr. Evil, you know, he's the head of the AEC, who authorized all the nuclear testing and did, you know, was put up in lawsuits at Vanderbilt University for radiating pregnant women. And he's telling you this may be the answer to what he calls the environmental pollution residue problem.
All right, David. My question to you is, what is the hole they
okay,
claim?
Okay, on the other side, you have all these much lower caliber physicists in Congress way down the line saying, well, helium-3 is unstable. And yet, when you get these really high caliber physicists solving the problem of stability, and the test on the Super Cray 2s at Kirtland Air Force Base, which were requested by the Pentagon, Major General D. Lamberson, back in 1986, 87, they're all saying that it's a go. The feasibility study says it's a go. The super brain physicists, the Nobel laureates are saying we should do it. There's a very good chance we'll succeed. It's the amateur
and
physicists.
If there should be a failure, and if helium-3 would become unstable, what would the result be?
It would just fail. It would not produce a bomb or anything like that. You wouldn't have any. There's no radiation in helium-3. It's the most benign of all nuclear fuels. It's our government fusion program, which uses tritium, which is, you know, H-bomb fuel, and deuterium, which is H-bomb fuel, produces, 18 MeV, and 70% of it, 60 to 80% of it, depending on the mixture, is pure energy-carrying neutrons, which is total radioactivity.
So all right, so at the end of the day, you're telling me that all of these people said no.
Everyone said no.
Right, and the reason is economic. In other words, the disruption, the change to the world's economy would be too much of a shock. It would cost too many powerful, important, rich people too much money.
Exactly. Let me give you an amazing visual here. Clinton Ashworth, who I interviewed, this was back in the late 80s, was supervising mechanical engineer for Pacific Gas and Electric, said a space shuttle cargo bay full of moon dust has enough helium-3 in it to meet the entire energy demands of the United States for an entire year. One cargo bay. Just a little bit of moon dust. Now, remember all the programs that were done on alien mining operations on the moon and the other moonlets in the solar system? And
yes.
That is your key signature on a possible fuel source for some of these UFOs. What are all these scars on these, you know, Hoagland has pointed out on the moon. In fact, Hoagland had mentioned helium, but he didn't.
All right, is it, we brought back moon rocks, right?
Yeah, we brought back moon rocks.
So do we know for a fact that there's excessive amounts of...
Yes, we do. That's an absolutely established fact. The other source, according to the University of Wisconsin at Madison, who did a study into, you know...
Wait. I want to stop because I want to understand this.
Okay.
Are you saying that for a given amount of moon dust or rocks or whatever material you'd gather from the moon, there would be many times more recoverable helium-3? Is that correct?
Yes.
Then there would be here on Earth for the same?
Oh, it's loaded with it, yes. And you can also breed helium-3.
Wait, and Earth is not loaded?
No, it's not. It's rare on Earth. It's an isotope that you have to manufacture. It exists in deep ocean vents. There are these ocean vents that are way deep under the ocean.
Yes.
And you can find helium-3 down there. But the best source we know of in the in the solar system is the moon.
And the moon.
Moon dust. So maybe that's what,
I had always heard, David, that the moon rocks were unremarkable, that they were virtually undistinguishable from rocks on Earth.
I've seen them at the Smithsonian universe. Undistinguishable? No, they're a little different looking. They're kind of, a rock is a rock is a rock, but there's something different about them. But moon dust is different than the rocks, I believe. I mean, they're not quite the same thing.
There's quite a bit of moon dust, although not as much as they thought, as I recall. When they landed, they thought there was some chance they might actually sink in moon dust, and that didn't occur. But there was, nevertheless, dust there, and you're saying it has a very high concentration of helium-3.
Very high. It's loaded.
Enough so that it would make it financially feasible if we were using that as fuel to bring it from the moon?
Yes. Yeah, it would be very feasible. In fact, they actually did studies into that. Clinton Ashworth at PG&E was doing studies. And incidentally, when I brought Edison, John Bryson had a bunch of his junior physicists. And you should have seen these guys. I mean, this guy's name was Glenn Duckett, Dr. Glenn Duckett, and he was probably in his late 20s. And I bring him into a room with Murray Gell-Mann and Glenn Seaborg and Magwitch, and he is his jaw is dropping. I mean, these guys are his mentors. And he's supposed to come in and evaluate for Edison helium-3 fusion and how it works and is it feasible.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, Edison said, and this was the final word from Bryson's office, we don't really need a new energy source right now. We've got all the electric power we can use, and we're not going to do anything. That was the final word from Edison. And it was just ridiculous. I mean, every single person said no. And to see Al Gore personally knew about the hearing and the date and had no interest in showing up to even learn about it was terrifying to me. And even Greenpeace, their head nuclear scientist, Eric Furst, was not even interested in the conversation. Meanwhile, NASA, Earl Van Landingham, head of propulsion, power, and energy at NASA, and James Fletcher are like begging Congress, please give us the money.
Mm-hmm.
We only need $10-20 million. That's
okay, well, I can actually see how that might develop and why NASA would have a particular interest in it, certainly. Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Aside from the private sector energy sources here on Earth, they would have a unusual, peculiar interest in this, absolutely. But
sure.
You're saying they got shut down just as quickly as you did. Because be developed for NASA, there would then be an immediate private sector. You know, everything rolls from NASA downhill to industry, it seems like, and so that's what would happen. It would get out, so they couldn't let that happen, is what you're saying.
Well, there's another angle, and it's a completely different angle on the possible conspiracy against it, is that Magwitch told me in Russia there was an actual moratorium against all research into true non-radioactive nuclear energy. And the very first nuclear energy-producing experiment ever done was done by John Cockcroft and Ernest T.S. Walton, British scientists. They won the Nobel Prize for bombarding lithium with protons, I believe it was, and they produced a non-radioactive nuclear reaction. That was before Einstein wrote the famous letter to President Roosevelt in 1938 urging the fission of uranium. And then what happened after 38 is, of course, the Manhattan Project started to mature. A young 26-year-old physicist named Alfred O. C. Neer discovers the explosive uranium isotope. And somehow Glenn Seaborg and Macmillan win the Nobel Prize for discovering plutonium, when really it was probably Alfred O. C. Neer, another German scientist. And then the Manhattan Project starts, and we all know what happened. But that's where it all went. There was actually, prior to the bomb, the first nuclear reactions were non-radioactive. But why didn't we put any funding into it? The reason, this is where I'm going to get to the answer here.
Okay.
And that is that there was a fear that if utilities knew, and there was a major announcement, like when cold fusion broke, it was all over the world. If helium-3 fusion was a success, every utility company in the world would buy it, for one, because it's dirt cheap, there's no radioactivity, power would be pennies per kilowatt hour, and hydrogen, the hydrogen fuel economy would be very economical because you have a cheap electricity and you can make cheap hydrogen. And what ends up happening is they say, well, if you don't have a neutron source in your nuclear reactor, non-radioactive nuclear power plants, how would DOD get its weapons-grade plutonium? Because they basically use breeder reactors to breed plutonium. And further, we say, okay, we have enough plutonium. We have enough nuclear warheads now. We don't need any more plutonium. But ta-da, there's another answer. The neutron bomb, the hydrogen bomb, uses tritium. And tritium, you have to, you know, breed it. It has a half-life of 12 and a half years, so it decays very rapidly. In other words, it very quickly it becomes it's basically useless. You can't really use it anymore, so you have to keep replacing it. Therefore, you need a neutron source to keep breeding more tritium, and that means you need radioactive power plants. So it's a possibility, and again, I can't prove this, that DOD overruled DOE's decision on this and said we are going to continue with the moratorium against this because we need our radioactive source for building, you know, nuclear weapons fuel.
Why not both?
Or why not both, the oil companies and this theory? I mean, there's really no logical answer. There you are in Congress with handfuls of Nobel laureates, handfuls of them, and Maxwell Prize-winning physicists like Norman Rockstocker, and the Maxwell Prize is higher than the Nobel Prize in physics.
Tell you an interesting story, David.
It's amazing, and no funding. So anyway, the physicist retires. He goes on to bomb detection, which he hired me in 1995, 1996, to do bomb detection, and went on to solve the riddle for better airport security and better bomb detection. And he won't even do fusion anymore. He's so tired of the conspiracy to silence him and to stop the movement.
All right. Tell you an interesting story, David. When I was 13, I was visiting a man who lived down the street from me in a place called Media, Pennsylvania. That's where I lived at the time. And the fellow who was turning me into a ham operator was also a physicist. Mm-hmm. And he taught me the basics of electronics and electricity and helped me get my license and all the rest of it. He was an amazing man named Paul Weiss. And he was working on ways to get nuclear reactions from non-conventional nuclear materials,
right,
from other types of materials. And I recall he spent quite a bit of time talking to me about that. So that work, that would have been about, 45, 48, 58, about 1958 is when that would have been, and we obviously were working very hard and looking at other things at that point. And of course, that was, you know, long after we exploded the bomb. What do you think happened to that research? I mean,
well, that's exactly the point. I mean, you can bombard lithium. There's a number of different fuels that are very low in radioactivity, although helium-3 is undoubtedly, the holy grail.
What do you think is going to happen, David? Do you think this holy grail is going to be unveiled as we get to the last of the oil? And by the way, was that a correct statement that
shocked. There was CNN on a couple of weeks ago, including the BBC followed up on this and confirmed the same report that the Royal Dutch Shell and all the other oil companies have underestimated the global oil reserves, and with China and all of the new the extra consumption of oil on a global level, we are basically finished cheap oil in 2026, and then we have to rely on extracting it from tar sands and all these other much more expensive ways to get oil.
It says here, Royal Dutch claims global oil reserves will be dry.
Yeah,
by
they
2026.
Did say that.
So they actually
pretty much finished.
They actually said dry.
Yeah. I couldn't believe this report. And then it's like, okay, good night, you're on your own. We don't have a follow-up, and neither do we have an answer. And I was just shaking my head going, I spent my life devoted to a physicist and other physicists who have solutions for the crisis at hand, and there's no funding. In fact, I'm doing a documentary film right now on this project in New Mexico called Angel's Nest, and we're looking at all of the sustainable housing development models that are using solar power, wind, and hydrogen,
mm-hmm.
and how to get your home off the grid in contrast to, you know, existing ways that we produce electricity, such as nuclear. And I've interviewed people at nuclear power plants like at Palo Verde. And
so do you think by 2026 or sometime just prior, they're going to pull the Holy Grail from its temporary a banishment place and fire it up?
Well, it's not that easy because the. Let me tell you, this is so amazing. I mean, people like Einstein and Tesla, you know, this happens if we're lucky every 50 years. If you're lucky, the universe will produce or our world will produce a genius. And then, if there is a true genius, they have to get funding to be prolific.
That's right.
And if they don't, you don't fund these guys, you may be dry and crawling through the desert for another 50 or 100 years before another genius is born.
Well, you might not fund them in 2004, but you might in 2024.
You might. You never know. But Magwitch is, you know, he's focused on bomb detection now. He's tired. Unless someone throws him a check with no questions asked, he won't even talk to you anymore because he's so burnt out.
All right. Hold it right there, David. So we're all right. David, let's rock a little bit. Let's get updates on a couple of UFO cases, one in Mexico, the other in Venice. What can you tell us?
Okay, well, let's actually, for the one in Mexico, and this is a bit of a twist, but let's go back to the night of March 12, 2001, when I was on your show with James Oberg. And the moment Oberg and I were arguing about whether the cameras on the shuttle, the black and white cameras, could see the invisible ultraviolet and infrared, Oberg said it couldn't, and I had absolutely confirmed this with the head of astrochemistry at NASA, Joseph Knuth, that the camera could see near ultraviolet and infrared.
Okay.
And that was the moment, right down to the second, that the internet and the satellite turned off and we were booted off the air.
Yes.
Now, before we go to Mexico again, let's go to, okay, Dan Aykroyd was producing a show called Out There in 2000 on the Sci-Fi Channel. He told me, this was days before I was to be flown to New York for my show, he was interviewing Stephen Greer, and lo and behold, during the taping, they were taping as if live, James Oberg calls in, good old James Oberg at NASA, and Oberg calls in and was really upset, Dan said. I mean, I just interviewed Aykroyd for an hour and 20 minutes for my next film, Evidence 2.
Yeah, and everybody will recall I had Dan Aykroyd on the show with you as well.
That was December 5th, 2001. Then what happens is Aykroyd tells me in the interview the other day, I was interviewing him on the set, and he said within 24 hours, he was standing outside during one of the breaks, and Oberg, he said, was very disturbed by Stephen Greer, the fact that he had so many credible, you know, Air Force pilots and astronauts like Cooper testifying to having seen UFOs. Aykroyd said he was on his cell phone. This is kind of funny. He was talking to Britney Spears, and he turned and looked, and he saw a black sedan, long sedan, with men standing outside, black sunglasses, black suits, and with these earpieces in, and he said they beckoned him with a look of total intimidation. And Dan, Brittany said something to him. He said he turns his head.
You mean like, want to take a ride?
Want to take a ride. And then he turns and looks back, and the car is gone, and he said there's no way it could have hopped over the other cars. The men were standing outside the car. There's no way in a turn of a neck that they could have disappeared. And he is convinced that these guys were some sort of interdimensional, who knows, limousine. And then what happens?
Maybe it was just an effect of talking to Britney.
Well, no, watch what happens next.
Mm.
Within 24 hours, his show is canceled. Now, remember, we had Oberg on with us, and the show, the satellite turned off, and the internet turned off.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
And Aykroyd has Oberg on his show with Stephen Greer.
Poof.
His whole show is canceled. Sci-Fi tells him the show is canceled. In fact, they tied him up in lawsuits so he couldn't even sell it to another network.
Hmm.
Now, isn't that interesting? Now, that's you know, I was supposed to fly to New York 2 days later to do my show with Dan, and he said,
I remember the cancellation. I remember the shock of the cancellation. Yeah.
Dan and Peter Aykroyd are both disturbed to this day. I think it was an apparition for his eyes only to let him know that someone at a higher level had shut down his show, because this wasn't mere entertainment. This was Stephen Greer with Project Disclosure, and this was, you know, me with the NASA stuff. So, you know, and then, okay, now let's go to Mexico. all of a sudden Mexico happens. We have, let's look at the science on this, and it's pretty easy.
Well, describe for everybody what happened in Mexico.
Okay, in Mexico, what happens, I got a call from a friend of mine named David Sadler, who ran for Congress in Illinois, and he tipped me off to Jaime Musson doing this huge press conference in the early part of the month of May, and I notified Bob Tarlow, who's senior producer at Fox News. Tarlow gets the tape and puts it on Fox National within 6 hours. I mean, it was on National Fox. That footage was everywhere. And then all of a sudden, all the other stations followed pursuit, and I went on with George Noory that night to talk about it. Now, what is peculiar about the Mexico case and why it's so relevant to my work at with the NASA UFOs is, once again, we have 11 UFOs confirmed on forward-looking infrared cameras that were, and three were detected on radar. The remaining eight were not, and they surrounded their aircraft, intimidating the pilots. And so let's look at, I have a very deep investigation into the Mexico case.
This really seems like almost a smoking gun kind of case.
It's absolutely smoking gun because you have no visual confirmation. And that is the same as the NASA tapes. We have translucent disks of light that are very large, perhaps 2 to 3 miles in diameter, only visible on the ultraviolet cameras.
Right, but again, with respect to the Mexican case, where has this gone? Because many of these things just get dropped like they went off a cliff and you don't hear anything else.
I was interviewing, again for evidence, to a man named Ken Stork up in Denver, who was U.S. Air Force retired, and he said, Stork used to work in drug enforcement, he said Space Command had picked up these UFOs all the way down in, I believe it was Venezuela, and we notified the Mexican Air Force. Let me just clarify for people what Space Command is. Space Command has also satellite cameras that observe the Earth 24 hours a day in the visible wavelengths from the color red to violet. They also look in ultraviolet, near and far, and they look in infrared. We didn't know whether they were visible or not, but we got a signal. We notified their Air Force. So that means they flew all the way from South America through Central America into Mexico. They launch their drug enforcement jets that have U.S. forward-looking infrared cameras, which really I have to clarify here, because forward-looking infrared are not ordinary infrared cameras. They incorporate two wavelengths of infrared, low frequency and high frequency infrared. They fuse them together so you get a two-dimensional infrared image with tremendous resolution.
David, I've been sitting in a Black Hawk, and I've played with that radar.
Oh, you have?
Oh, yes, I have.
Wow.
And it's remarkable. I mean, it's... actually, for those of you who can't imagine it, it's really the next thing to a photograph. It's kind of looking like, it's almost like looking at a negative photograph, and you can make out shapes of human beings, shapes of aircraft that are on the runway, if a car is driving past on a highway near the runway, you can see that. Everything in proper proportion, and you have quite a clear view.
Incredibly clear, beyond any normal infrared camera.
And absolutely.
I researched through DOD, and we have new infrared cameras, that forward-looking infrared cameras, that are so far beyond the ones we sold Mexico, it would, I mean, really just make people's eyes pop wide open.
I'm sure.
So here's the deal. Now, remember, we have, a temperature, they're flying at, 13,000 feet. It's minus, according to Jaime Musson's report, it's minus 26 degrees up there, which is easy to understand at that altitude. Then you get this infrared signature, very clear. In fact, the one that they target in on the it's called advanced target forward-looking infrared. You'll see the little X's. They actually target the objects. And that's for you know, our military response.
Sure.
You can look at one of them with what they actually, they square in on. You'll see a long cylinder-like thing with a round, you know, bulb or light shining from it. So you can see this thing has structure. But everyone is duped in this case because you have mass gone invisible. Now, I go back to my UFO sighting in Berkeley, 67, 68, and after 20 minutes of watching this shiny metallic disc, we saw it blink out. It just disappeared. So the question is, where did it go? And let's go even further back. Let's go back to, in fact, this gentleman came to my attention after Evidence One, the case for NASA UFOs, came out, and he saw it. Trevor James Constable is the author of The Cosmic Pulse of Life. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Okay. 1976, he publishes his book. Trevor Constable is a retired British naval officer from World War II who started to notice invisible objects showing up on radar during World War II. And one case he cites in his book is called the Nansei Shoto case, where off the coast of Okinawa, Japan, our aircraft carriers saw on radar what we thought were 300 enemy aircraft doing 700 miles an hour. It was either 300 enemy aircraft or one whopping object, but we couldn't
imagine. That would get your attention.
That would get your attention. And, of course, we couldn't do 700 miles an hour in World War II because that's just beyond the sound barrier, and we didn't break it yet. So we thought the Russians or the Germans were going to clobber us. So we launched our fighters up on a clear day, very good visibility. Nothing is there, yet radar on the ship is saying, we have confirmation, you're right on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing there. Now, those ghosts would show up on radar from time to time. So Trevor Constable goes out with a 35-millimeter camera, and he decides he's going to start taking pictures in the invisible. Using high-speed infrared film without red filter, you get near UV sensitivity plus infrared.
Sure.
He goes out in 1958 where a man named George Van Tassel is allegedly psychically channeling extraterrestrials. And I know that sounds kind of hokey, but he took pictures all around Van Tassel, and he had a large audience, and UFOs, a translucent large disks of light, oriented at steep angles away from the camera with black holes in the center, identical to the UFOs in the STS-75 missions, show up on his film. And that's why he got a hold of me. I mean, through my friend Lou Gatto, Lou Gatto introduced me to Constable and said, you have to read his book, and I'm like, oh, it's so old, I don't want to read it. And I finally read it, and Trevor Constable sees my video and says, we have to get together. When I saw his photos, I was just like, oh, my God, I've got NASA in checkmate. I mean, these are the argument at NASA on the STS-75 was we're looking at out-of-focus airy disk, which when a near-field piece of dust floats close to the camera, it produces this blob of out-of-focus light around it. Well, an airy disk cannot turn on a steep angle away from the camera like you'll see in Constable's photos, but they still have the black holes in the center, just like the ones that I cited in STS-75 and the other missions. So it looks like we have double confirmation of the same phenomena. And some of the objects that showed up on Constable's photography, he believes, are biological organisms.
Didn't somebody in the Mexican situation actually come out and almost make an official statement, or did make an official statement, suggesting that this was absolute proof of extraterrestrial beings visiting Earth?
It's got to be absolute proof. I mean, to me, what they're doing, to explain Mexico properly, I believe, and I have to make this simple for the audience, that because Einstein's law prohibits mass or spacecraft from attaining the speed of light, because it, as you go faster, inertia pushes on you and you get heavier, and the heavier you get, the more energy it takes to go a little bit faster. In subatomic particle accelerators, where we test acceleration on protons and muons, you know, the components of atoms, we have got protons at Fermi Lab in Chicago up to 99.99% the speed of light. So how much energy does it take to get a mass that fast? Well, it takes a trillion electron volts of energy. A nuclear bomb releases 200 million using plutonium, 200 million electron volts. So a trillion is 5,000 times more energy than the bomb.
Right.
Now, when I asked at the end of the long conversation with Earl Van Lanningham at NASA about fusion, I popped a big question on him, and I said, have you guys made contact with extraterrestrials? And he said, no. When you consider Einstein's law, the amount of energy it would take to get a spacecraft to be doing 99% the speed of light, he said the energy signal radiating from that craft would be so massive, it would be 1 trillion electron volts, would be so massive that every amateur radio astronomer in the world would see the signal moving towards Earth well in advance of the arrival of the spacecraft. And he said, we have never seen anything like that yet. Now, he's right, because you could never cover this up. Every amateur astronomer, it would be like the movie Contact. You would see a whopping, you know, a terabyte signal, a trillion bytes, beyond the Jansky signal, the gigawatt signal they're seeing in the movie. I mean, a trillion is so far beyond that.
Yeah, if it's fully a physical, real manifestation, then yes.
Yes, that's the point. Now, in my theory, I say it's impossible for too many reasons. One, no physical materials can produce energy levels that high. And even if you could get a spacecraft to even do one-tenth the speed of light, imagine the G-forces on even a subtle turn. They're going to crush the craft and the pilot. Even like, say you have to steer out of the way from an asteroid or an incoming moonlet. You're finished. The G-forces on a quick turn like that are going to destroy you going that fast.
Sure.
Second, imagine if you hit a rock floating in space. It's just going to puncture holes in you and blow you to pieces. But my theory, I reverse the table. I actually get into this very deeply, which, you know, it's very hard to do unless you have paper and a chalkboard in front of you. I believe they convert their mass into light, which means their craft go from a heavy mass state into a zero mass state.
Right.
And once a spacecraft is as light as a photon, guess how much energy it takes to do the speed of light?
Nowhere near as much.
Nothing. A couple of volts. Because we can send radio photons out at a few volts throughout space.
Quite true.
And so that would mean that NASA could not detect a signal. See, this is the fundamental point of why mainstream physicists do not take the UFO phenomena seriously, because they don't see the energy signal tagged on to the incoming objects. They see no energy signal. But if you have a zero energy signal and your craft is pure waveform energy, and I demonstrate this in my work very clearly, we'll get into the Venice UFO in a minute too. Because
yeah, the problem is they are here.
They are here.
Mexico happened.
And if their craft are pure ultraviolet wavelengths are they're higher in temperature than visible light. Now imagine minus 26 degrees at 26,000 feet, and this high temperature signal imprints that humidity. Actually, according to Hamid Musan's report, it was quite humid. That humidity in the atmosphere gets hot, and an infrared camera sees it like an infrared beacon, so you get an image print, like a fingerprint, against the atmosphere in the infrared, but the real UFO is way up higher. It's up in the X-ray, gamma ray, ultraviolet. It's way up there. That's what I believe happened, and that, when we look at the radar report, now radar is microwaves. We bounce microwaves out. We saw three of the Mexican UFOs on radar, but the remaining eight were not. Now
That's right. Is
perfect, showing you how they have, some of them are in translucent mass states where the microwave photons just pass right through them like butter and you get no signal. And some of the others are in very low mass states, but still invisible. And some of the photons, or the radar photons, bounce off of them, and you get a signal. So they're basically telling you. I mean, if you read the signs, you can see exactly what they're doing. You have to become ultimately so frustrated with the idea of increasing energy on mass propulsion to come to the conclusion that they're doing it a different way. And the different way is, they're not, I don't believe they're doing what Bob Lazar says. Bob Lazar's theory says is they are building their own gravity generators using element 115, which element 115, plutonium is like 97. So 115 has more visible energy than plutonium. So he's increasing energy on mass, and in fact, if you increase an object's or a spacecraft's gravity, you have to increase its mass, because that's how you increase gravity.
There have been some rather tantalizing stories recently about element 115. You're aware of that?
I know. I'm very aware. At Berkeley, they finally duplicated it, and what's really disturbing to me is Bob Lazar's formula is so close. It's so close to how they actually did it at Berkeley. In fact, they're on to element 116 now, but they
yes,
have not.
Yes, I know. Hold on, David. We're here at the bottom of the hour. As a man who has been researching this for many years now, David, I do want to ask you this. I mean, we are in whatever you want to call it right now. You know, the times are hot. I mean, I get calls from Whitley, from everybody else who watches the number of events going on and the magnitude of the events going on, and everybody's saying it. You know, we're having a major ongoing event right now. Do you think Do you think all this is headed toward some sort of resolution, climax, understanding, whatever, of what it is that's been happening to us all these years? Are we about to get there?
It really seems like that. In fact, I've been telling all my friends that. I mean, you have the Mexico March 5th, you have the Venice UFOs, which I'm personally involved with, which were just May 2nd, and another one on the 26th in Venice. There were two sightings by Patrick Uskert, who has clear video footage of a metallic disc, and you can see the same wave distortion, the pulsating waves that you see in the NASA UFOs, which I think is the secret to their propulsion systems.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the ones up in Sonora, which I'm about to personally go up and investigate.
Well, tell me a little about Venice.
Well, Venice is amazing. I mean, it's you know, this guy's walking home, walking to the beach or from the beach with his girlfriend. He sees this thing that looks like a hubcap flying up there. And then he's like, wait a minute. I mean, Patrick's like, oh, my God, hubcaps don't fly, and what's it doing up there? And there are other people looking at it, up at it. And, well, he tells his girlfriend to maintain a position on it. Well, he goes and gets the video camera, runs back, and starts shooting this thing. And it's really one of the most amazing piece of footages for me because I feel like I'm looking back at the same UFO I saw in 67, 68 in Berkeley. And it's got the same properties, the shimmering steel.
I'm informed your website is down. Do you have video of this on your website?
Which website? LA UFO or?
Oh, well, let's see which one.
You can see this on laufo.com, I think.
Really?
Let me go to LA UFO because that's going to be my new site for the new. We're doing a whole documentary on this right now. Which will be out by the end of the month, hopefully.
Okay, I'm on your site, ufonasa.com.
Oh, that's down.
That's what I heard.
Really?
Now, let me see if I can bring it back. No, I can bring it back. It's back up now.
Okay.
Anyway, you're suggesting there is video of this. And what's to be seen in the video? Describe
it. Well, the Venice UFO has, again, the evidence of the strobing wave formations that you will see consistent in this UFO phenomenon. And again, I think all throughout the UFO phenomenon, you will see evidence of the zero mass concept, what I call a zero mass spaceship. Doesn't mean it doesn't. The craft does not have protons, neutrons, and electrons in its atomic structure. I believe the frequency of the wave state of mass transforms to a state that resembles that of photons. And once spaceships are made into pure light energy, and the pilots, they can suddenly turn on a dime, which you'll see in the evidence UFO tapes. And
whatever they are and whatever their
propulsion
composition and propulsion and all the rest of it, we all want to know what's going on. And you've investigated for years. When we finally do find out what's going on, what kind of revelation do you expect possible, David?
Well, the first revelation, and we look at, you know, here we are coming to the end of our oil reserves. It's a terrifying moment for us. We have to get on to hydrogen and all these other fuels. We did not spend proper research funding on all of that, on the breakthroughs in solar power, the nuclear fusion, and we're sitting here with nothing. And these UFOs are beckoning us with an energy solution and a propulsion technology that could revolutionize life for us on Earth. So that is the first thing, I think, that they beckon us with, is that possibility, if we could reverse engineer it.
Why would you believe that they would benignly land and hand over to us a technology we may not be ready to proceed with for any number of reasons or handle or who knows what all, but why would you even believe they're benign, and do you?
Well, really, those are huge questions, but
yes.
I mean, really, we have no proof that they're benign. We have no proof that they're harmful.
Well, there are those who would make arguments, David, that when you take people
uh-huh.
against their will, that's not a benign act.
Okay, well, let's look at that. I mean, let's look at what we do when we go into a frog pond in biology class, and we pull a frog out, and we spread it on the table.
And cut it open. Yeah,
that's right. Cut it open. To them, we're just biology.
Well, if that's all we are, if we're nothing more than frogs to be cut open on the table, then we as frogs have reason to be really concerned.
I mean, if you were from a Buddhist perspective, you can't even cut the frog open on the table. You should love all beings equally. But, you know, yes, I would agree. Yeah, that is not, you know, a friendly thing to do when you're looking halfway across the universe for intelligent life. But what would we do? Say, you know, the Mars lunar probe, you know, the Mars probes actually found evidence of life. Would we take samples? Would we take one home and analyze it? I mean, what would we do? I'm not 100% convinced that abduction is necessarily from their intentions, a malevolent act. But from our side, it's absolutely malevolent.
Well, we have to look at things from our side.
Our side.
In other words, if they regard us as we would an ant farm or something awful like that, then we have
a lot to fear.
We have a lot to fear, sure, and it would not be benign, not by our point of view.
Not by our standards. Yeah. But on the other hand, if they do have an energy technology far beyond ours, and I believe we're close at understanding how their craft work, we're very close, and I believe John Hutchison, who is a friend of mine also, who is very close also to understanding and true anti-gravity. In fact, Hutchison has been able to get steel disappear.
Well, okay. Why, David, I know I'm going to be asking questions here that you probably have no answer to, but I really have to ask, since you've looked at this so hard and for so long.
For so long, yeah.
Why would they be present and perhaps have been present in the world since 1947 and maybe long before that, for all we know? Do you think it started, by the way, with Roswell?
Well, when we see these ancient Middle Eastern paintings, or sorry, Middle Age paintings with the UFOs in the background,
painting,
you know, this has got to be going on. And we think of the wheels of Ezekiel and the visions of Enoch.
Yes,
this has got to be going on for a long time. But I think we are coming to a head. There are so many UFOs right now. I mean, in fact, there's more video evidence in the last couple of months than I've ever seen in my life. I mean, Turkey, Iran. You have Oregon, you have Sonora, California, you have the Venice UFOs, you have Mexico.
Yep, I get the picture, and I understand what you're saying, but I want to kind of try to grasp a little bit of the best understanding I can of what they might be about. Mm-hmm. And if they've been visiting us, maybe a bad word, observing us, or whatever it is they've been doing. I mean, we've got abductions, we've got crop circles that we might attribute to them. We've got a lot of things going on that I have looked at very carefully, and I don't necessarily, from our perspective, consider them to be friendly. So if we're headed toward a meet of some kind, I guess I would ask, what do you think they've been doing all this time? Just watching? Participating? Or what?
It'd be very easy for them to tune into our radio and television broadcasts and see what we're doing down here.
Yes.
So for one, they could see that we're not, you know, we're destroying our planet. We're not a very evolved species technologically yet. We do a lot of beautiful things down here. I mean, just imagine. I was talking to Aykroyd about this in the interview I was just doing with him for evidence too about the music. I mean, if they tuned into, and by the way, I love the music you play. Those little clips of music. They come on between the breaks, just in that half-in, half-out, you know, half-asleep state. It's just dreamland for me. It just puts me in the most incredible state of mind.
Yes.
Love the music. And I think, well, they would listen to our music. I mean, they might be very curious about us. I don't necessarily think they're malevolent. I mean, they haven't actually confronted us yet, but it does seem like things are coming to a head here.
Well, it may be because of rap.
Maybe.
You see, we're sending rap up
we're
to them
sending
now.
Rap
and if anything
rap.
Will produce a negative result for humanity, it's rap.
Well, when we expose plants to rap music, apparently they shrivel up and die. So who knows what rap is doing in space?
Well, if they're making judgments based on so-called music.
But then they would also listen to the blues, and they listen to classical. I think music would tell an extraterrestrial civilization just on its tonality if they couldn't understand our language.
Tonality? Well, then in that case, there's going to be one more rap song, and the death ray is going to shine.
Eminem is going to be the cause of us all.
Yeah. So, but all this time and all this observation? Do you think that's what it is? Observation, David, or?
I would like to think that going into the ancient Sumerian stuff and going into the wheels of Ezekiel, that we have a species out there. Yes, there might be some that would like to take over our planet, but I would like to think that there are angels. I mean, this may be a fantasy. It may be, hopefully it happens, that will intervene and save us on you know, their behalf, because they are our ancient creators. I believe that if we created in a lab experiment, say we will get to the point where we can do interstellar travel, if we can attain the speed of light in the next 100 years or 200 years, we will have the ability to seed life and seed civilizations on other planets.
Perhaps so, but we, but you have you said something that you just ran right over, and you can't just run right over it. You said in a fast sentence, you included, they are our creators.
Our creators.
Yes.
Now, what if we created life on another planet? Wouldn't we want to come back and check on it once in a
while? Absolutely. Why? So you believe that that's what they're doing. They're checking on their creation.
They're a little lab experiment. They started this civilization millennia ago, and they're just checking in from time to time to see how are the humans coming along, you know? Like, they started us out.
But this is a very serious matter.
Very serious matter.
And you can't just run over it that quickly. If they are our creators, and I'd like to understand how you came to believe that, aside from the fact that there is, as you point out, there are cave drawings that would indicate perhaps people who wore spacesuits or the equivalent were here. I mean, there's all kinds of intriguing stuff inscribed everywhere, including on stone. So,
And Zechariah Sitchin's work.
Yes. So what convinced you that they are our creators?
Well, I can't say that the particular ones who are visiting us right now. I've had a number of my own mystical experiences, but that's another subject. For myself, I'm convinced that there are certain extraterrestrials here who have the greatest intentions for us. Aykroyd proposes the most logical way to do this, and that is to have a proper, you know, landing and form and exchange of information, rather than just coming in, slamming in, and abducting people without, you know, without, you know, permission.
All right. Really. Well, while we're on that subject, the premise proffered in Taken, that series on TV, and not just born there, but really taken from ufology, is that there is a tampering with our genetic structure going on, perhaps for their benefit, or if you are the half-full glass of water kind of guy, then for our benefit, or maybe mutual benefit, or God knows what else. I mean, all kinds of possibilities, but they are tampering with or changing. Everything's oriented toward reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
All the stories, reproduction and genetic works. Now, where do you, what do you believe in that area?
Well, okay, let me just put myself in the perspective of the creator. If I don't mean the supreme creator of the universe, I mean perhaps those who biologically engineered us or co-engineered us.
Yes.
And I said, well, you know, they're not really figuring this out too well, and they seem to be making a lot of mistakes. Maybe they're not wired right, you know. And I'm speaking to myself here too. I'm not speaking like I've got it all together. That would mean they would have to correct a deficiency in the program, in the genetic code on the human species, to wonder why they're so destructive. Why are they so bent on you know, building bombs and going to wars with each other and blowing each other up and polluting the planet to no ends? Yet they also do a lot of beautiful things, I would say. Incredible music, incredible art, amazing things are being done down here with science. And I would be, as an observer, I would be quite proud of the human race in many aspects.
Aren't they natural results of the free will gene?
Well, that, I think that, here's, I mean, in a nutshell, what I really believe on a deeper level is that we, when, and going back to the parable of the fall into the Garden of Eden, we partook of a knowledge called good and evil. And good and evil, to me, is a conflict. It's a duality. It's a conflict by its nature. If you ingest good and evil, you ingest conflict. And if a billion souls take in the knowledge of good and evil, when you have a conflict in your life, the first thing we usually do is we try to solve it. And by defining good and evil egotistically, individually, we all came up with different versions of what is good and what is evil. What my religion is right and yours is wrong. My philosophy or political system is better, is right and yours is wrong. And because by the nature of good and evil, it is a conflict initially, it is a lower vibration than what we call unity or oneness. So in oneness, there is no duality. There is no conflict. But when you take in the knowledge of conflict, you go into a state that is lower than oneness, so you fall into a dual state of mind. And all the great mystics have said that when we attain enlightenment, we're going beyond duality. We're actually, you know, going beyond the internal state of conflict. I believe that internal conflict caused us to, our DNA to become electrically separate. It's imagine this oneness field of light, and then all of a sudden there's this swirling polarity of positive and negative, and that swirling energy builds a force field or egg, a barrier around the soul, shielding it out of the oneness or the connectedness to the universe. And in that separate state, it malfunctions. It lives in a state of conflict. It interprets good and evil differently than all of its neighbors, so they're always disagreeing and fighting. And I think that will eventually, if you know how a cell entropies and dies, the way cell structures reach entropy and die is they are cut off. They no longer receive inflows of energy. And when a system no longer is open, it eventually runs out of energy and collapses in on itself. It fails. It dies. So our DNA, if it's coded the same way as that same duality that we all face, it will eventually malfunction. It will fall apart until it reunites itself with a higher, more unified field of energy.
As in a hybrid? That's a reunification with that other part of the genetic structure, isn't it?
Well, that's kind of, if you're meaning from the movie Taken, becoming
not
part
necessarily.
Of,
I'm just talking generally now about the stories we get of abductees.
Right. Yeah. There's the idea of the one mind. I mean, the collective mind, which is, you know, to me is quite scary actually, to be controlled by a single mind or entity, and everyone lives in a dictatorship in that mind, I think would be horrific.
The hive.
The hive, yeah, exactly. The concept of the hive. I think that's very different.
Well, but maybe that is the oneness. Are you sure you're not arguing something that would turn out to be a terror for you?
Well, for myself, and, you know, I've practiced meditation for, you know, 25 years on a daily basis. The states of non-duality that I've gone into are very beautiful states. There's no terror in them at all.
All right, hold it right there, David. We're at the top of the hour. We are going to open the phone lines for David Sirita. Allow you to ask anything you want. Wonder if you ever thought of that, David, that if they were to actually reveal themselves and then reveal themselves to be our creators, we'd indeed, we would have one whale of a new religion that would bring you right to your knees.
Well, there is the case of Zaytun in Egypt in the late 60s, and it also started in the year 2000. BBC and ABC News reported this. There were orbs of light in the sky over Egypt that looked like UFOs, photographed in 1968, accompanied by apparitions of the Virgin Mary that were full-blown visible apparitions. That's at zeytun-eg.org. on the internet, and those photographs were, you know, that made the back pages of the New York Times in the late 60s. 2 million people, according to the BBC, flooded the town of Assiut in the year 2000. And again, these orbs of light are in the sky, and this incredible translucent, luminous body of light of the Virgin Mary appears, and there are documented healings, and Muslims and Christians are all praying together to her, and it was all over the news in England. I mean, I remember it, and I actually wanted to go out there with my video camera and try to film it, but I never could get there. But and they went on for quite a while. And again, that is a UFO phenomena associated with a full-blown apparition of a, you know, a mystical figure. And that would not be a new religion. That would be kind of a revelation on our existing religion, because a lot of Catholics and Protestants and born-agains don't believe that angels have to travel in light ships or UFOs.
It might be that, David.
It might be that. This is a well-documented case.
On the other hand, if they're our creators, that means that with technology, they created us. And that would be in some conflict with the biblical version.
Well, it would be. You know, if they, I mean, if what Zechariah Sitchin says from the Enuma Elish, which predates the book of Genesis, the seven tablets of creation describe demigods and goddesses who collectively created us physically in vitro, in test tubes, and they manipulated DNA. They mixed the DNA of themselves with the evolving Neanderthal species on Earth and co-created the first Adam and Eve. And that's, again, well documented.
And there you are again, David, with reproductive and genetic stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I mean, it literally could happen that we will have that power ourselves. I mean, all we need is the ability to go interstellar, and if we find a planet that could sustain life with no one living on it, we might start, giving birth to a new generation and a new planet, and that generation would look back at us and say we were gods.
Yes, if we don't blow ourselves to smithereens.
If we don't blow ourselves to smithereens first.
And I'd say it's a big race. Listen, let's take some calls. First-time caller line, you're on the air with David Sarita. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Mike. Let's just say my name's John Doe. I'm a tech sergeant with the Air Force out of Big Spring, Texas.
Oh?
I don't know if you've heard about it. I currently work at a faculty formerly known as Hangar 18.
Oh?
And our job is basically... The craft was too big to move, so we are currently guarding it and keeping it from everybody else.
You claim you're guarding an extraterrestrial craft.
Yes, I am. My CO won't let me. He allowed me to use our phone to call out.
To call a talk show and say, hey, we're guarding an extraterrestrial craft. Your CO approved that?
Unofficially, yes.
Well, your CO has lots of guts, is all I can say. All right, so you claim you're calling from what we know in history as Hangar 18.
That's affirmative.
Okay. It's an opportunity I can't pass up. But what can you tell me, and David, since he's listening, about the nature of the craft that you guard?
The craft is approximately 380 feet long. And 287 feet wide. There were 17 bodies originally found on the craft, and of course every one of them was deceased. The craft crashed, and the government covered it up.
And you've been guarding it how long?
I have been in the Air Force for 17 years.
Yes, sir.
And I have been on this project for approximately the last 5.5 years.
5.5 years. David, this is a very unusual opportunity. I mean, what would you say? I mean, here you are, my guest. What do you say to a caller like this?
Well, I try to be 100% open-minded. I would ask him, I'd ask you that, have you seen the craft do anything, or is it dismantled? Does it activate in any kind of a state? Has it anyone done studies into its energy and propulsion system?
As far as I can tell from the propulsion systems, I'm no expert, but from the scientists that I've seen studying it, if you will, they tell me that the propulsion system is dead, that apparently when it crashed it was on its last legs, if you will, and... It was more or less, I guess when it entered our atmosphere, it was more or less on its last legs. From what I've heard, they said that it was basically a trinium and hydrogen combination that powered it. I'm no scientist, but that's what I overheard them say.
Yeah, that would be quite radioactive. So is there any presence of radioactivity, or is there any...
At my current duty station, I'm approximately probably 30 feet from the left rear of the craft. And just from looking at it, I would say there's no radioactiveness left in it. We don't wear no protective suits or anything like that.
What does it look like?
It's kind of, I wouldn't say a triangle. It's kind of like a triangle, but every corner, the three edges are rounded. And there's three big bulges below it on each corner, and a bunch of little bulges in between each corner. And that's the best way I have to describe it.
How many people do you think have knowledge, guards and scientists and others that you've seen, have knowledge of the existence of this craft, where it is?
I would say, like I said, I've been on this project for quite a while, and I would say that on any given day, I'll probably see 200 or 300 people.
My God.
And I would say that there's probably at least a few thousand that know of its existence that I have seen personally.
That you're making this call itself doesn't seem logical. In other words, it's obviously a very secret thing, and here you are, a guard, having talked to his commander, calling a national talk show. How did that come about?
We're pretty, I wouldn't say pretty big fans. We listen to the radio quite a lot here.
Well,
and a lot of times we listen to this show late at night. It's the only thing interesting on.
Uh-huh.
And my CO, he agreed with me, and he said, hey, other people believe we need to let these people know that there's something out here. This crashed a long time ago. From what I've heard, it crashed in 1958.
Are you and your CO willing to go any further?
We've talked about it, and I don't know about him, but I damn sure am.
You are?
Yes, I am.
Do you know how to get in touch with me?
I have your line that I called on tonight, and that's the only number I've got.
All right. I refer to email.
No, I don't.
You're not able to email?
I can, but I'm kind of afraid to.
Afraid to.
I was more or less told that if I wanted to call in, I'd call in. Who's going to believe me? Nobody else. My CO said, I'll let you make the call. And I have the means to email at my home, but I'm kind of afraid to.
Email a way that you would feel safe in communicating. Just do that much.
Go to a library
to a computer where, you know, a public library or something like that, and fire me an email with a suggestion on how we can exchange information.
Okay.
How about that, all right?
That'll work.
All right.
I actually have three videotapes that I made.
Oh?
And that I say three. I have one that I have made, and I have two that were given to me with the specs for the craft, and I actually have the one I have on tape actually has the craft with bodies.
Oh, Sergeant, we really need to talk. So, Art Bell at mindspring.com or Art Bell at AOL.com. That's my name. You'll not forget that at either one of those two addresses, and we'll take it from there. All right?
Okay. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Sergeant. Take care. You never know, David.
You never know.
You just never know.
You can't be negative, and you can't be too enthusiastic, but you know, if he's telling the truth, then you know, you might have something there.
Well, maybe it's a good moment to stop and ask you. I mean, we do have Roswell, David,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah,
you know, other crashes said to have occurred in that area. We have perhaps other crashes we've heard of in South Africa and other locations. Do you believe there is a crash retrieval program? Do you believe we have recovered alien craft?
Oh, I do. And let me tell you about Roswell, because this is a view, you know, once you understand the concept of a craft turning into pure, you know, ultraviolet wavelength energy or higher.
Yes.
Now let's look at Roswell. This is really interesting. Check this theory out. Okay. July 5th, 1945, or it was between the 5th and the 17th, the dates fluctuate, we detonated the first atomic bomb near White Sands, New Mexico. Now, July 7th, 1947, 2 years later, same dates, of the year, on either side of the nuclear test site in New Mexico,
yes,
you have the Plains of San Augustine crash, and you have the crash at Roswell.
That's right.
Now, just imagine, visualize this for a moment, audience, that you have craft, just like in the case of Mexico, you have interdimensional craft that are vibrating at very high frequency wavelengths.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a nuclear bomb releases 200 million electron volts of energy with a lot of gamma radiation. Now, if you're pure wavelength craft, that gamma burst, in tremendous gamma burst, is going to upset you. It's in other words, if you're not physical anymore, you're pure wavelength, what you're vulnerable to is something similar to your frequency bursting at you.
Sure.
And you get thrown out on either side of the explosion, one towards Roswell and the other towards the Plains of St. Augustine. And 2 years later, we see the effects, not instantaneously. Now, the question in the theory is, why 2 years later?
Well, there's that, David, and then there's also just the fact that such an explosion would be apparent to anybody who had been observing us at all in any way. That explosion would have been a major bell ringing, indicating a certain major advance event had occurred on Earth. It would be like ringing the great big bell, saying,
well, they might have been hovering around saying, what are these guys doing with this thing? And
in a
nuclear bomb tears into the fabric of the different dimensions. So it's not just affecting our dimension.
Mm-hmm.
But the curiosity is why July 7th, 1947, and we tested July 5th through the 17th. The date is not clear. 1945, and you get two UFO crashes on either side of the explosion. I mean,
yes,
it's really peculiar.
Well, I don't disagree with you. So, in answer to the question, you obviously do believe we have them.
Oh, yeah.
And they're under some kind of guard being held somewhere. And what? Reverse engineered?
I believe Robert Lazar,
I was about to ask
going
about that,
back to element 115 and the experiments done at Berkeley, which are very recent, just in the last couple of years, they have finally produced element 115, and it's the formula, the way they did it, I read it, it's almost identical to Lazar's theory. In fact, how could he have been so accurate with a formula that is decades old at this point? And decades later, they duplicate and produce element 115 with almost the exact formula that he gave out. Now,
I agree. My chin hit my chest when I heard it. I went, oh, my God.
You know, in my theory, to convert mass into a light, initially you would need a huge burst of energy to affect a great amount of mass.
Yes.
But once that mass is reduced to pure light energy, to maintain it, you need next to no energy. I don't believe they're using energy in the form of propulsion the way we do. They use a huge energy burst to reduce mass by altering the wave state of mass, and I believe they do it similar to the Hutchison effect. And once that craft or steel of that craft is pure light energy, it takes very tiny amounts of energy of strobing waves to maintain it in that state.
All right, hold tight. Wild card line, you're on the air with David Sirita. A quick one before the bottom of the hour here.
David, Art, this is Mel in Montana.
Hey, Mel.
How are you? Okay, I love you guys. And obviously, we've both seen that big triangle black craft.
Yes.
And before that, I had a camera in the crop circle, and I took a picture, and I didn't realize later, and I looked at the picture later, it was completely black, and I see a little alien face in it. It looked like a hologram in the size of, you know, it's definitely an alien face. I showed it to everybody, and they go, whoa, that's an alien face.
And you got it. You took a photograph in a crop circle.
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there have been four crop circles right in my area. And you can really definitely, and it's like a hologram. You can only see it when the sun hits it.
All right. Well, David, let me ask you, crop circles, animal mutilations, the stories we've had of cattle being taken up in beams, all the rest of it, these inexplicable things, particularly crop circles and the mutilations, are you convinced they're connected to alien presence?
Oh, absolutely. I think reading the wave formations in the crop circles, if you look at the spiraling wave and weave of the grass, and you look at the spiraling wave strobing out of the NASA UFO photos, you'll see a resemblance, a remarkable resemblance in the wave patterns in these crafts' propulsion systems.
And do you believe them to be communicative or what?
Oh, I think there is a blueprint in the crop circles. I think if you run those through, any particle physicist who looked at crop circles would understand what they're doing. That has the signature of mass going into a higher frequency wave state written all over it. I mean, conversion of mass into light. I mean, mass is low in frequency, light gets very high in frequency. And I think if you strobe mass with a series of waves, just like John Hutchison does with the steel cannonball,
right,
the cannonball levitates. That message, if you know how to read it, is in the crop circle.
All right, hold tight. We're at the bottom of the hour, and we'll be right back from the high desert. The subject of our present abduction is David Sirita, and you're invited to call up and probe. He has a book, folks. It's called Evidence, the Case for NASA UFOs. So if you're tantalized by what you hear today and want to know more, that would seem a logical place to go. And when you say NASA UFOs, in what context do you mean that, David?
Well, I mean, it's a three-hour documentary and film. I'm working on part two right now, which should be ready in October. These are a deep investigation into UFO phenomena captured on space shuttle mission cameras during the 1990s. It's a collection of the Martin Stubbs work, and he archived hundreds and hundreds of hours of NASA missions and noticed many incidences of UFOs, and I did a study at NASA at a very high level with their physicists and scientists. Some of the astronauts have talked to me and other physicists outside of the agency to, you know, probe into the phenomena and look for answers.
How much have astronauts really told you? I've had some of the oddest responses, David, when I've interviewed astronauts. Even some that have been to the moon. Really odd responses. How about you?
Well, the astronauts themselves, like even Edgar Mitchell, really couldn't conceive of the idea of a zero-mass spacecraft. He says if there's no mass, there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
And I look for zero-mass signals. He, like many classical physicists, don't accept the UFO phenomena because they're looking for that huge energy signal tagged onto a massive spacecraft, and they don't see it.
Yes, but are there any astronauts who, in fact, reported seeing UFOs?
Cooper, Gordon Cooper, I read his book, Leap of Faith. Him and I, he was on a Fox TV special on the Fox News in L.A. that ran after the X-Files grand finale with me.
Have you been told anything in private by any of them that goes beyond what we know?
Not by the astronauts, but John Schussler, who was an engineer on Gemini and also retired at NASA in 1998, the last thing he did is built the Advanced Propulsion Lab for NASA. He is now the head of MUFON. I'm speaking at Roswell, incidentally, and MUFON this summer, this month, in July 3rd in Roswell and July 16th at MUFON Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And Schussler is now the head of MUFON. So I asked him, what are you doing in the UFO movement? I mean, you're NASA, basically. Oberg used to work for Schussler.
Yes.
And Schussler will tell you on and on that many encounters that astronauts had with UFOs, in fact, he keeps reports on the sightings by the astronauts. And when he answered me, he said the reason he's in the UFO movement is he wants to understand their technology. He believes rocket science and rocket propulsion is ancient stuff that we need to get on to. He's very fond of my theory of converting mass into light, or changing the wave state of mass and allowing it to resemble the quality of a photon and attain the speed of light on tiny amounts of energy. I mean, he believes that's the only way it's possible.
All right, more calls, David. Here they come. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with David Sirita. Hello.
Hi, my name is Tammy. I'm calling from Ventura, California.
Yes, Tammy.
And actually, I'd like to ask a question, and then if I can, I would like to share something I saw last week.
Ventura?
Ventura, yes.
Yeah, you're just north of me.
Okay. Well, that's even better. Maybe you saw what I saw. Real quick question here. Could you explain why everything spins?
Thin?
Spin.
Well, what do you mean by that? What did you see that was thin?
The galaxies and the universe, the planets.
Oh, that's a pretty wide question. They all do spin, that's true.
Oh, why does everything spin? I thought you said, why does everything thin?
No, spin.
Well, that's, you know, again, everything has a different spin speed. Everything is in a wave-particle relationship in our universe. The brain is a wave-particle machine. The planet is a particle that is spinning around a wave around the solar system. The solar system is a collection of wave particles that spins around the galactic core every 250 million years. Everything is spinning, which is particles and waves. And those particle-wave relationships have frequency, meaning how frequently they make a revolution. So when you study the wave-particle relationship of matter and you study the wave-particle relationship of light, you start to get your answer on how you go from mass into light state.
Okay.
So, yes, everything's spinning.
Okay.
All right. Last Saturday, it was actually Saturday morning into Sunday. It was like 1:30 in the morning. This is amazing. I've been trying all week to get through on this. It was a meteorite. It was approximately 500 feet, I would say, actually by size, by like two palm trees high, two palm trees distance from me.
Mm-hmm.
I just got a glance of it as it was just coming down to the earth. Mm-hmm. It was huge, and it was very, very hot. It got my right cheek was just really, really hot. And it seemed to me like it landed maybe about 2 or 3 miles away. It had no sound effect whatsoever, and it had a tail on it 12 to 14 feet. It was a ball of fire. Within 3 hours, there's a gleet of fire going on, which actually burnt, and it shut down lanes of Highway 101. It burnt 6,000 acres. They really never mentioned anything about it other than it burnt 6,000 acres.
You're convinced that started the fire?
Yes. Oh, yes. They evacuated Carpinteria and Montecito.
Wow.
And what dates are you looking at?
I'm looking on the 5th. Actually, it was the 6th, okay?
Of
it was,
what?
Of this month. It was last week.
6th of June.
Yes.
Oh, she said a week ago.
And I'm sorry, Art. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, you said a week ago, virtually when I was doing this program, actually.
Yes, it was you, and you were talking to the astronomer. That's when the stars were all lining up.
Yes.
It was that night. Actually, it was the night after the one that happened that came down in Washington, the exact night right after that.
Wow, I heard about the one in Washington.
Okay, now I've asked seven different people here. And nobody has seen it. I'm just blown away.
Nobody has seen a meteoric impact. There's no hole. There's no crater.
Well, it's not that so much. Nobody else.
There's been no media on it.
Yeah.
Nobody. You don't even hear people talking it because it happened. It was huge.
Many should have seen it, right?
Oh, you bet. You bet. And within hours, that fire had started and. There's not been a word on that fire whatsoever about anything. It was just kind of like brought up to us, our attention, and then dropped.
Is the fire out now?
Yeah. And actually,
Carpinteria?
No, it was in Goleta.
Goleta, okay.
Goleta. That's just north of Santa Barbara. Well,
oh, my God.
Yeah, and I tell you, it has to have been seen by some astronomer, somebody, because when I seen it, it had probably a good minutes before it got out of my vision, and actually there's a hill that goes over the coast there, and I thought, oh my God, it went over there to this like the camp.
Well, maybe in the center of that location where the fire occurred, somebody might want to take a stroll out and take a look for what might be there. That's
I know someone who lives out there. I'll have to call.
Pretty remarkable story, actually.
Really remarkable. I mean, there could be something. Like in the Betty Cash case, you had a UFO that was very hot and caused severe radiation burns. If you have heat on your cheek, do you have any like rashes or anything unnoticeable? I mean, different on your body right now?
No, she's now gone. But but that is remarkable. And
I'm going to check that area out because I know someone who lives up there.
In addition, she's right. Many would have seen it, so I'll watch my email and see if we can get confirmation of what she just said.
See, there's so much going on right now.
I know. That's the only way I know to follow up. If others have or saw that, and if there's confirmation for it, then we want to follow up.
Wow.
Okay, first time caller line, you're on the air with David Sarita. Hello.
Yes, Art and David, it's nice to talk to you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
I currently am a government employee, and I'm not going to say what branch I'm in or my name for my own, you know, for my own career purposes.
Yes.
But I can promise you, Art, that several years ago in the early 90s when I first started working for the government, I actually was one of those people who answered the phone at a local base. And when we received UFO calls, we were told to act like we were actually taking the information and ignore it and move on.
You were told to act like you were really taking the information and just forget it and move on, not really even make note of it.
Right, right. Like it was, like it wasn't even going on. You know, they said act concerned and then press on. But my question for David is what do you think about the time travelers, the time traveler theory?
It's a good question. I'm going to get you off the hook here, sir. I can hear you covering up the radio. Thank you.
Okay, thank
right,
you.
Uh-huh. That was somebody in security, well, or a police officer now. Very, very, that's fascinating. I mean, the man, obviously in security, just told us that he was told to take calls and then just blow them off. I mean, make like you were writing down the information and blow it off. Can you believe that?
Well, it's interesting because Patrick Oostert and I, with the Venice UFO, we called the FAA, and in fact, we've taped this in the documentary. And the FAA took us really seriously. In fact, a week later, I called them, and they still remembered. And I sent them a copy of the DVD of the full, you know, editing job and zooming in close on the Venice UFO, and they're looking at it right now. So I don't know if they're brushing it off, but they did a radar search and found nothing from Santa Monica Airport or LAX to confirm the location and time of the UFO. So that would mean it's either invisible to radar, which is not surprising, or they just don't want to tell us that they had an incident on radar.
All right. Well, the second part of what he said was also pretty fascinating. A logical mind, considering the possibility of time travel, even the amount of energy we know is required to achieve time travel, still has to imagine that if we don't blow ourselves up, someday we will find that power and we will achieve time travel. If that would be true, then it would be reasonable to have an expectation of time travelers.
I think there are two ways. The current approach with wormholes, I mean, look at Kip Thorne's book, you know, Black Holes and Time Warps. The energy required to create a wormhole to fold two points in space-time to go basically obviate the speed of light and get there shorter requires the energy, what's called the negative energy, of every sun in our galaxy, the energy they put out for a whole year. So that's 100 million suns. All of their negative solar energy for a whole year to make one wormhole with a narrow snout enough to fit a dime through. The wider that snout gets, the more energy required. These are ridiculous numbers, but and they're unattainable. I mean, no one can produce energy levels that high. But if you're zero mass, once again, you can do zero mass wormholes on tiny amounts of energy. And therefore, once you figure out how to do zero mass time wormholes. Yeah, you could move through time. You could. I believe time also is a wave-particle relationship. I mean, if you really look at time, the particle planet spinning around the sun once per year, that's a particle-wave relationship. So if you look at time in a wave-particle model, which I have done in my galactic clock, which is a clock I invented for measuring all wave-particle relationships in all four dimensions, I believe I can prove that every event has already happened in actuality. It's only time that inhibits us from moving forwards and backwards through those events. But they've all actually happened. In fact, Richard Feynman, the great physicist, did this experiment with an electron where he proved the same thing. He calls it the sum over history. For the electron, all events have happened already.
But some of what we observe with UFOs almost seems paranormal because you've said it yourself of the apparent disappearances and that sort of thing. Well, if there were time travelers and if they were here observing or interacting in whatever way might be possible, given the rules of time travel, whatever they turn out to be, Well, they might be time travelers. Have you thought that one over?
Oh, I believe it's absolutely possible, because what I'm saying is if every event has already happened, and instead of moving at the speed of light or faster to manipulate time, I believe you move on the time wave itself. It has its own wave. And therefore, yeah, you can move forward and backwards in time. Apparently there was a guy you had on your show who was a time travel expert, and he just vanished after he did your show. I can't remember his name.
Actually,
do you remember who that was?
There is more than one. Believe me, there's more than one. So actually there's perhaps three people who have come forward with pretty serious time travel stories. They're gone.
Maybe they moved in time, and that's where they are. David Anderson.
Remember
that's
him? Remarkable stories about time travel.
And he's gone. No one knows where he is.
He's disappeared.
In fact, my friend Lou Gatto is looking feverish.
Madman Markham is gone. He's never reappeared.
They figured out the secret, and they moved, and they're in another, what Feynman calls, another history.
Well, it's at least one of the things that you have to consider, bearing in mind they were talking about time travel, and now they're not here any longer. That seems like a lot. Anyway, look, we're very short on time. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with David Sirita. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes, I've got a question for David.
Fire away.
Okay. Has anybody, I'm sure they have thought about the fact that here's these people, whoever they are, it could have been here the whole time. Let's say they from a planet that died out. Hey, maybe Mars. They come here, they've got some kind of prime directive, they don't want to mix in with the people.
Right.
Or the, you know what I'm saying? And they stay invisible. Well, maybe now our technology is catching up to them where they can no longer stay invisible. Maybe now it's coming time where they might have to interact with us.
I don't think David would disagree with you at all. We're beginning to see them because of technology we have developed, right, David?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I even got a call from an individual who works in Space Command, and they said they see these things coming in on visible satellites all the time, on infrared and UV. And he said almost everyone who works in Space Command sees these things all on a fairly regular basis. So, yeah, I mean, even physically, I mean, they could, again, you know, once you can, and Christ did this in the resurrection. He took flesh and turned it into light. And once you're light, you can disappear in different dimensions of light, or you can become a visible body of light at will. So they could be here amongst us and remain cloaked in this invisible dimension. And if we start looking with these incredible infrared cameras and UV cameras, we will start to see them.
I think that was a yes, caller, and I'm afraid we're out of time. David, I want to give you a chance to plug your book, The Case for NASA UFOs. And I know that you have tapes, I believe, as well, right?
Well, people can, you know, tomorrow morning you can either order through UFONASA.com or go 1-877-UFO NASA, toll free from within the United States. But the other thing is, Evidence 2 is coming out September, October, which is a packed film. It's got a bonus DVD with an hour and 20 minutes unplugged with Dan Aykroyd, which is an incredible, mind-blowing interview. And also the Venice UFO film I'm going to put out in the next couple of months with Patrick Uskert, and all of the California sightings up in Sonora will be in a full documentary as well. So I've got two new films coming out this year.
And when can people begin ordering those?
They can check on LAUFO.com, because all my new stuff is going to be there. It's probably, you know, late September, October, it should be ready. Yeah.
So you've been very busy.
I've been busy the whole last year doing interviews. I've interviewed Hutchison, Trevor James Constable. I've interviewed people like John Schussler. There's a lot of them, actually, in the next Evidence film. I believe I've got NASA checkmated in this new one. And the Aykroyd interview was incredible. I mean, that man's mind on UFOs is wow. I mean, he's far more evolved. To me, he's Einstein crammed into a comedian's body.
And on that note, we've got to go. David Sirita, thank you.
Thank you, Art. It's been a pleasure.
It has indeed. Good night, my friend. And to all of you, have a wonderful week. George is back tomorrow night. I'm Art Bell. And for this night and this weekend from the high desert, good night.